Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we chat with Billy Porter. We also review Casa Valentina, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Of Mice and Men, and The Cripple of Inishmen. Please stay tuned.
Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad, but the world goes round. Sometimes you lose every nickel you had, but the world goes round. Sometimes your dreams get broken in pieces, but that doesn't alter a thing. Take it from me, there's still gonna be a summer, a winter, a fall, and a spring.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 27th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Good morning. With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Billy Porter is this incredible performer that I'm a huge fan of, and I can't be objective about because I love him too much. And Billy, thank you so much for taking some time to come on Broadway Radio. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm great. I'm amazing. Life is good.
So you're coming on right now. We're going to talk a little bit about your new CD, Billy's Back on Broadway. So tell us, how did Billy's Back on Broadway come about?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I got the Kinky Boots gig, and Lisa Barbarese, who is Cyndi Lauper's manager, sort of approached me about, you know, shopping for a deal. And after my last experience in the 90s with the record business, I was sort of done with it. But she convinced me that the business has changed. And so I sort of sent her out and said, okay, if it has changed, then prove it to me. And she did. And, you know, we landed on Concord Records. You know, one of the hugest changes is that, you know, making a Broadway album was the idea that came from inside the label, which I thought was something that was extraordinary, considering back in the 90s when I wanted to make a Broadway album, they laughed me out of the room. So, you know, that's how it happens, and we're here.
Well, what I'm curious about is the two songs are certainly from long ago. One was popular once upon a time, once never was popular, and yet you've rediscovered it. So the first one that was popular once upon a time is I've Got to Be Me.
Yes.
So where did you first run into that? Was it the famous Sammy Davis recording?
Yeah, it was the Sammy Davis Jr. recording many, many, many years ago. And I was putting this album together and sort of just trying to figure out marketing and you know, just the whole package. You know, Sammy Davis was a man and an entertainer and an artist who transcended race, and he transcended genre, and he was just a Renaissance man. And I really feel like that's what I connect with the most. That's the sort of version of the artist that I connected with the most. And so I wanted to pay homage to him on this record and sort of pick up the torch, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking for a Sammy Davis Jr. song to sing, and that was the one that sort of fit into the theme of what we chose for the album.
Right. Now, that's from Golden Rainbow. The other one I'm curious about is Take the Moment from Do I Hear a Waltz. How did you discover that one?
Well, that's my favorite.
Ah.
On the album, interestingly enough, and I thank you very much for hearing that. you know, it's I'm a huge, huge fan of Sondheim. I'm a huge fan of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I put together a musical review called The Soul of Sondheim for the Reprise concert series out in L.A. back in 2009, which is the equivalent of Encores here in New York.
Right.
And so I put this together, and it was Richard Rodgers' songs done in all of the African-American idioms of music, from R&B to soul to jazz to gospel to, hip-hop, all of that stuff. And so this was from that concert. And I discovered it while I was researching for that concert and found this gem of a song. And so I pulled it. I plucked it from that show that I worked on.
Now, Billy, you're from Pittsburgh, yes?
Yes.
Yes. I first encountered Billy back in the day at Don't Tell Mama. You used to come in and sing with the open mic frequently. Was that pretty much the first venue in which you performed in New York?
Pretty much. I mean, I got off the bus and sniffed out Don't Tell Mamas, and I pretty much sang there every day, every night, till 4 a.m. for at least the first 10 years I lived in New York. You know, that's where I cut my teeth. That's where I got my training. That's where I learned how to, communicate, because when you're in a smoky bar, a smoky, loud club, when you hone the skill set of silencing that room, you're ready.
And this was so long ago that it was definitely smoky.
Smoky, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. It was very smoky. It was very smoky and very loud.
All right. Now, here's the title, Billy's Back on Broadway. There's no question there was quite a hiatus between you being in Greece and being in Kinky Boots. During that period of time, were you saying to yourself, it'll never happen again, I'll never get back to Broadway, or it's only a matter of time?
It depended on the day.
I suppose.
It was a 13-year break from 1999 when I returned to play the role of John in Miss Saigon to when I came back with Kinky Boots. And, that's the hard part about the business. It's like, it's about longevity. The race is not given to the swift, nor is it given to the strong, but the one who endures to the end. And sometimes that's hard, getting to that place where you can sort of sustain yourself even when the work is not necessarily readily at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting journey.
Billy, we talked a little about cutting your teeth and doing your training here at Don't Tell Mamas, but you also did attend that little school, Carnegie Mellon. Where a few people came out of that program. There must be something in the water there in Pittsburgh.
Yes, it's one of the best programs in the country, and I learned my craft there. I honed it here, mm-hmm. But to get the toolkit together, that's where you sort of get that, all those tools. You learn how to use the tools, in practice and process. I loved being there. I love Pittsburgh. I loved Carnegie Mellon. It changed my life.
So talking about changing your life, last June, your life changed a little bit during your acceptance speech for your Tony Award. You said you share it with everybody, but you're going to hold on to it in your apartment.
Now, listen. You have to say it. You have to say it the right way.
Okay, do it for me. Do it for me right now.
What I said was, with my co-star, who I love so much, my little brother, Stark Sands, I said, I share this award with you. I'm going to keep it at my house, but I share it with you. You know, it's in the cadence. It's in the dialogue, the colloquialism that the humor comes from.
Yeah. That's why you're Billy Porter and I'm not.
The New York Times reprinted it, and they reprinted it like sort of in the proper way. And I was like, no, that's not funny.
definitely loses something, yes.
So tell us, where do you keep it?
Well, right now, it's on an awards tray. I got a big tray of awards, basically, from West Elm under my television, because I'm still designing my apartment.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm actually building a little shelf for it. But the shelf is not built yet. So that the Tony and my Grammy are sitting under my television.
Wow. That's wonderful.
So I get to look at it all the time when I'm watching TV.
Well, after it's done and all designed, you have to put up a picture of that on your Instagram account.
Absolutely. You know I will.
You can go to billyporter.com and find Billy's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram stuff, as well as his amazing, beautiful website. It's just, highly reflective of the man. Billy, thank you so much for joining us and telling
us. Thanks for having me.
All righty. You have a wonderful day.
Until then,
too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye.
So Billy he's got so many great stories about the business, and especially his story about being in and out of the business. And I don't know, did you guys see the video I sent you on the he was having a discussion at Carnegie Mellon University. He went back as an alumni to talk about his experiences. The whole video is about an hour and a half. And I posted it on BroadwayRadio.com. So if anybody wants to get a chance to take a look at it, the beginning of the video, the audio is not great, but it gets better. And it's really, really very fun. Watch, although it is an hour 20 minutes or so. And he talks about a lot of his experiences in Kinky Boots and the process of putting up Kinky Boots and also as we know, putting together these shows is not always a very stable ride.
Right.
But there's a lot of personality involved. You know, Jerry Mitchell, a director choreographer, and Harvey Fierstein writing it, and all these other folks involved. And we have another Harvey Fierstein show to talk about, don't we now?
Yes.
So Casa Valentina is a play that has just opened, and Michael and Peter have gotten a chance to see it. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I certainly shall. I thought it was extraordinary. This is a story about a number of men who go up to the Catskills every year, and once they're up there, they can be themselves, as they say, because these are men who are transvestites. Not drag queens exactly, there is a difference, but transvestites, because they enjoy dressing as women clothes, they feel very feminine about it, and some of them are more out than others, especially Charlotte, who's Reed Burney. In an extraordinary performance, though, frankly, they're all terrific. He wants to mobilize these men. And by the way, we're talking about a time long ago, about 50 years ago. So he wants to mobilize them and start a genuine, and this is the term used, sorority, that's a 501c3 corporation. And this certainly threatens most of the other men who say, hey, I've got to be secret about this. This is not a good thing. The play does get amazingly homophobic at times because these men claim to be straight, and there's a lot of unfortunate language in there that's surprising to come from Harvey Fierstein. However, he's being very fair in showing who these men really were, that it was too much to have anything to do with sexuality with another man. That is something that was just, and these men who do have sex with other men are treated as 12th class citizens in these guys' minds. Many of them have wives, and this is just something they do and has nothing to do with sexuality as far as they're concerned. What's really something is that one of them, Patrick Page, playing George or Valentina, depending on the scene, is married to a woman named Rita, who, and they together have this resort where people come, and not unlike the Cherry Orchard, it's in tough shape. But wow, Rita is tremendously understanding of her husband, very supportive, enthusiastic even to some degree, though that will change by the time the play ends. One of the men, played by Larry Pine, is actually a judge. And we will find as time goes on that he does have some other inclinations sexually, and that's going to cause a great number of problems at the resort. It also winds up having his daughter, his grown daughter, come to the resort, and she has no tolerance for this lifestyle whatsoever. And she gives a speech that's pretty devastating. It's very calm, but devastating in terms of what she has to say, because we've pretty much through 85% of the play say, well, you know, really, well, what's the harm? You know, if this is what these guys want to do, it's their business, so on and so forth. The speech that this woman gives, Lisa Emery plays her, by the way, really points out that it's not that simple. So I think Harvey Fierstein has been fair to all sides, and I think he's done a wonderful job. And more to the point, not only has he done a wonderful job in writing, but Joe Mantello has done a spectacular job in directing, because he never goes overboard. I was thinking of The Boys in the Band because there's a character in there named Emery who's super effeminate. And that was the point of it, to write that type of character. And here the corresponding character would have to be Bessie, played by Tom McGowan, who's the most flamboyant of the bunch. However, he never really crosses the line. I mean, while he's the most flamboyant, he isn't outrageous. He almost is, but not quite. So that was very much temperate and very smartly, certainly in conjunction with Justin Townsend, the lighting designer. When this play starts, we're pretty much in the dark. And we see these guys first in the dark, which is very smart because it makes us curious. And therefore, when the lights come up, we're ready for it. They ease us into this tremendously well. I thought it was one of the best plays of the season. And I won't be surprised if a lot of people have problems with it for one reason or another. But I was mesmerized. And I will also say the audience I was with was hanging on every word. It was spectacular to see an audience paying so much attention to a play, and I wish it well.
All right, Michael, what did you think about this?
Well, actually, I don't disagree with anything that Peter said, except maybe his last few sentences. I think it's a fascinating subject. I just don't think that Harvey Fierstein was up to it, unfortunately, because it really is fascinating, and there are many moments when it's working, and you think, you are riveted, because I don't know about you guys. It's something I, in particular, have absolutely never understood. Though I should mention, I knew, not very well, at least one of these people. There was a guy some years ago, I'm not sure if he's still around, who used to, a very, you know, stereotypically masculine-looking guy, who would go around dressed up as this woman named Linda. And he would hang out at – the reason I knew him is he would hang out at places like, I believe, Maurice Crisis. And he used to hang out at the old Danny's Skylight Room, Danny's Grand Seafood Palace on 46th Street before that was torn down. And, you know, he was just one of the community, and everyone knew him. And like a super straight male friend of mine would see him and just say, oh, hi, Linda. Oh, hi, how are you? And I really never got it. I think part of the issue is that as comes up in the play, well, in this play, we see seven, I believe, of these people, and we are initially made to understand that all of them are completely heterosexual, and they like to dress as women, not for sexual thrill reasons, but for some other reason that it's not that easy to define. Or in some cases, maybe they do get something of a sexual thrill by dressing up as women. Yet when they actually have sex with another person, they do it with women. But then, you know, then even though that's what we see here, then we do learn that at least one of the characters, as Peter said, the judge, does seem to actually be a repressed homosexual. And then there's even another speech between two of the characters. I think it's Reed Birney's character, and the other one is definitely Patrick Page's character, where it is suggested to Patrick Page that he becomes aroused when he is out dressed as a woman sitting at a bar, and a man comes over and compliments him and tells him how pretty he is. And Patrick Page doesn't really, he doesn't like outright deny it. So you can see he's kind of maybe thinking about it. So there were so many gray areas in the phenomenon itself it's truly fascinating. It's just that to me, there were, as is always the case with Harvey, a lot of very obvious things happen, a lot of things that it doesn't seem like human beings would ever behave that way. Many things happen that raise further questions. For example, one of the characters starts this quite long monologue about how he first became aware of and in touch with his feminine side, if that's the word for it. And one of the stories he tells is, I thought was really well written, about how when he got married, when he was in the hotel room suite with his wife on their honeymoon, and she went into the bathroom, and he just was compelled to put on some of her clothing. And then he says that the way that played out was that she came out of the bathroom, I guess, much sooner than he expected, and saw him, and he was horrified, but she just burst into laughter and thought it was the sweetest thing, and just said something to the effect of, "That's so sweet of you to, you know, kind of break the tension by making me laugh." So that's how he got out of that. And I thought that was a really wonderful moment and believable. But earlier in that same speech, he tells this, to me, ridiculous story about how he was, when he was in a school play, you know, it's implied that, I guess, grammar school maybe, and playing a prince, and he had a wonderful shiny armor costume, and that really, you know, gleamed under the lights, and it looked great, and he felt great. But then he saw one of the girls in the cast playing the princess with her beautiful dress and her tiara, and he apparently has a psychotic episode or something, and rips the tiara and the dress off of the girl. Now, I can't remember exactly if this was supposed to be during a performance, but even if it was just a rehearsal, I guess to me that implies some kind of really major mental, emotional issues. And that opens up that whole can of worms about as to how many, if any, of these people really do have some kind of psychopathology, and how many of them are some of them, I would imagine, you know, just given the percentages, that some of them must really be homosexual, and then they don't want to admit it. All the more so in this case, since the play is set in 1962, and you just did not do that. So really, really interesting subjects, not always well handled at all. Oh, and also let me say, the play ends with a lengthy conversation between the Patrick Page character, George / Valentina, and his wife, Mayor Winningham, played by Mayor Winningham, that it seemed to me, I think they would have had this conversation before. And I guess that's debatable, but it really did just seem to me that it was something that would have already happened, and they were just doing it for our purposes. There were also a lot of lines that seemed very informational. And another thing that bothered me is that every character in this is hyper articulate, to the point of, it sounds like they're reading essays that they've written, or entries in a manual or something like that. And I think a little more diversity in the way they spoke would have been very welcome. So that's pretty much what I have to say. But probably needless to say, acting superb across the board. John Cullum, an incredible. Gabriel Ebert in a completely different universe of a role than that he played in Matilda. Tom McGowan, mentioned by Peter. Reed Birney, who's always not once have I ever seen him in anything where he wasn't excellent. Patrick Page had a separate issue. He has that wonderfully rich voice that he's used in many classical and semi-classical roles. And on the one hand, it seemed a little odd coming from this girly woman dressed up in all this feminine attire, but it did. It was a different sound than the others created, so that was good. And Nick Westray, I have to single out, was exceptionally good. And Mayor Winningham as the one woman. I did think it was very effective to withhold Lisa Emery's appearance until the very end, I guess the penultimate scene of the play, and mm-hmm. she did a great job with that very very effective telling monologue.
Well, you know, it's funny because my reaction to that speech about the school play, and I thought to myself, gee, you know, Harvey knows this world, needless to say. I mean, he's the author of Torch Song Trilogy. He's no stranger to it. And I wondered where this story came from, and I had a feeling that it wasn't invented. So I gave it my forbearance under those circumstances, and that may be a leap that I shouldn't make, but nevertheless, it did occur to me that was a good possibility. In terms of everybody being articulate, yes, it's funny that I should stumble on that word, but anyway, sure, and that's a charge often made against boys in the band, too, that everybody's so smart and comes out with these wonderful lines. And while I certainly see your point, and I realize that that's not a good thing technically, it makes for an entertaining evening to hear all these people come up with so many funny, funny lines. So that's, at least from an entertainment value, we're reminded that the word art does have a basis in the word artifice. So, I'll stand by what I say. I was really, really terrifically taken by this. And the only thing I want to add to this, in case anybody's wondering, this Linda that Michael is talking about is not my girlfriend. She is someone else entirely.
Okay.
Isn't that true, Michael? You know them both, right?
Yes, I was told that the Linda that I was referencing was actually a plumber from the Bronx.
How funny. That's interesting.
So not to be confused with Peter's Linda.
Although it's really important to know a good plumber.
That's right.
My father was a plumber, in fact, and I wish he had taught me things because it would make life a lot easier for me in this apartment, but that's another story. It's funny, too, because so many people have said to us during this period of time, oh, you guys are working so hard. Every night you're at the theater. Oh, my God. You know, and I say, my father was a plumber. That was work. You know, this really isn't. When I walk down the street during the last week of April, I'm singing that song that most people sing at Christmas. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
So, speaking of the most wonderful time of the year, I got a chance, as well as Michael and Peter, to see Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which I thought was one of the most wonderful times of the year for me. Mm-hmm. How was it for you guys? Michael, you want to start us off with Hedwig?
I loved it. I've loved this show ever since I saw it way early on down at the Jane Street Theater with John Cameron Mitchell in the title role of the show that he co-created. And I'll never forget, it had already become quite the sensation, quite the downtown sensation. I don't know if they still have downtown sensations, but but at the time, because I was waiting for my tickets and Madonna was online behind me. And somebody said something to the effect of, you shouldn't have to wait for your tickets. And she said, I'm fine. Thank you.
Good.
And Peter Berg was there that night also. And I think that may have been the night that Madonna and Peter Berg hooked up, because they had a little thing going for a while. So it was quite, but aside from all that entertainment,
yes,
it was, I love the show. And it's not, I think Peter will know what I mean when I say it's not exactly the kind of show that I normally respond to in terms of the style of the music. But for that style, I think it's very well done. A lot of it is extremely melodious and catchy, particularly the song Wig in a Box. I love from the first moment I heard it. But there are several others. And just very witty banter in this an amazing story of a German youth who undergoes a sex change operation in order to come back to America and live with an American military man. And then that's where the title comes in. The angry inch refers to Hedwig's botched sex change operation because it didn't quite go all the way. So he's left with a remnant of what used to be his penis. I'm sorry if that's too graphic, but that's what it is. And you know what's kind of amusing? I've read press releases in recent weeks that called the show Hedwig and the Angry Itch. People who don't know the story, I guess they think that it must be a typo, so they fix it. But no, in fact, it is Inch. And it's basically, I won't say a one-man show, but to a large degree it is, because Hedwig is front and center through almost the whole show, played just brilliantly by Neil Patrick Harris, who, let me say right away, I was not sure about the casting, only because when Neil Patrick Harris has sung in more traditional musicals, although I thought his voice was fine, I always felt it was a little thin. And I did not expect that it would be up to this kind of very intense wailing rock music. But it sounded just fine. Obviously he seems to use a hand mic through much of the play. And so that helps somewhat, but he's singing it in a style that sounds perfectly valid and very powerful. And then of course he can also bring it down for the few moments when when the story gets very emotional, towards the end. Much praise also to Lena Hall, who plays Yitzhak, who is introduced as Hedwig's boyfriend, and he is part of the band also. And the biggest tribute to her is that I knew before going in that Yitzhak is actually played by a woman, but then I sort of forgot. And when he came out, I thought it was a guy. But then we see at the end of the show that it definitely is not. So that really, I mean, really props to Lena Hall for making me forget that she was really a woman for much of the show. I thought it was an excellent production directed by Michael Mayer. As you may have read, it would seem that John Cameron Mitchell has done considerable revisions for this particular production, because the concept here is the reason they're at the Belasco Theater. See, Hedwig normally plays little dives. So why is he at the Belasco? Because this mega budget production of Hurt Locker the musical had opened there and closed on opening night, so they wanted to have something to fill the theater, and they happened to have the night open, so they quickly booked Hedwig in there. And if you were lucky enough and you looked around in the theater, you got a four-page program playbill for Hurt Locker the musical, which includes such songs as Army of One, Baghdad Morning, Hot Desert Nights, Won't you buy my porn DVD? And then there's even a little note from the director of Hurt Locker, the musical, Kip Buckner. This is a collector's item. Please pick one up. And I assume that John Cameron Mitchell, I'm assuming he wrote all of that stuff, and it's just as clever and funny as the actual text of Hedwig with its additions and its revisals. So I really adored it. Oh, and let me say, the show was not nearly as loud as I had feared or heard. I mean, it's plenty loud, don't get me wrong, but it didn't seem inappropriately loud for a rock musical. I think that's one of the key differences. I don't suppose that... for example, Aladdin struck me as very loud. I can't imagine it was louder than Hedwig, and it may have even been a little less loud, but I think it bothered me because it seemed so inappropriate for that type of music. So that's my take on that. I didn't feel like my ears were in pain, and so I was able to really enjoy the score, which I think is terrific. I hope they do a new cast album.
So, Peter, what did you think about it?
Michael, the reason that you didn't think it was loud is because you lost your hearing at Aladdin. So now you need it to be. I didn't think it was loud either, by the way. Not overly loud. So of course it was loud, but not painfully so at all. But on that same issue, well, no, not same issue, but on a similar issue, I had also heard, oh my God, the lights that come from the stage and blind your eyes and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was going to be a problem for me too. Not at all. It did happen occasionally, but I didn't think it was excessively. And I think it happened more at Janis Joplin.
I meant to mention that. It was only like maybe once or twice at the beginning, and then one of the later numbers when things are starting to go crazy. And it was only for like a few seconds at a time. So that was not an issue for me.
I'm going to bring up something completely different. One thing that struck me about this show, this is a good show to go to if indeed you're experiencing a breakup with someone or are still hurting from a breakup. I know that sounds weird, but this is part of this show that Neil Patrick Harris's character Hedwig is certainly mourning the fact that he was involved with an entertainer named Tommy Gnosis. And Tommy, in fact, was essentially his mentee and leapfrogged over him. Mm-hmm. But the point is, the relationship has ended. And you can see that Hedwig is in pain over this. And it's very hard for Hedwig to come to terms with this, as it is for many of us when we're dumped. Yeah, and I know that nobody ever brings this up about Hedwig, but it's very poignant in many respects dealing with this issue. So if you've loved and lost, I think it's worthwhile to take this in. I think you'll find a kindred spirit up there, and maybe it might even help with your healing. I know that's bizarre, but nevertheless, it occurred to me while watching this show. Everything Michael says is absolutely right. Right on, no question about it. A big success, and all this talk that came before even the first preview that he was a lock for the Tony, it certainly isn't something that was contradicted by his performance, and none of us will be surprised if indeed he does win the Tony. He certainly deserves to. Certainly anybody else in that category on Tuesday, I think, will deserve to too. But nevertheless, here he is doing terribly well up there. And to me, by the way, utterly unrecognizable. Mm. It didn't even seem to be this guy I've seen hosting the Tonys. And speaking of unrecognizable, Lena Hall playing Yitzhak, when she comes back at the end, as
oh my god,
it didn't remind. If he comes up tomorrow, it's a different person. You know, I'm not going to be that surprised. I mean, I know it isn't, but it's that much of a transformation that's so spectacular. So I agree with Michael too. By the way, that as rock scores go, this one really hits the spot. So let's be very grateful that this is showing up at the beautiful Belasco, by the way, which is mentioned once, and also brings back the fact that this was the term used back in 1975 when the Rocky Horror Show played there and lasted no time at all. It was a quick failure, but they referred to it as the beautiful Belasco for that engagement. And so here we are with another musical that certainly is the grandchild of the Rocky Horror Show, but this one will do substantially better, at least on Broadway. The Rocky Horror Show, needless to say, had a history that lasted beyond Broadway, and even to some degree to this day. So good luck to Hedwig, good luck to Neil Patrick Harris, good luck to Lena Hall, and good luck to you if you've suffered a break up, really.
The Belasco is also used in that Hedwig asks one of the audience members to keep an eye out for the ghost of David Belasco.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then there are other his relationship with the audience is so wonderful and seemingly spontaneous and charming. I mean, I'm sure he has maybe some lines prepared for latecomers, but like, for example, at my performance, a woman came in after the first number, and she was smack dab in the second row, center of the second row, and he said, "Second row center, really?" and then after the very very stern warning from Yitzhak about cell phones before the show, he says, you know, something like, "It's a loud show, but some of it is soft, and so, you know, please, you don't want your phone going off, especially with this bitch up here." But somebody's phone went off, and sure enough, Hedwig stopped and said, "Who is it? Answer it. I want to know who it is."
Michael,
so he plays with everyone.
Michael, when did you see the show?
I saw it on, I'm sorry, it's been so many nights, it was just one second. It was Friday night.
Oh, I was there Friday night too, because I was like, oh, I hope that they weren't plants, because the same exact thing happens, and I was like, oh no.
Show.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
I was there on Thursday, none of that happened. So,
okay.
Did the David Belasco thing happen?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm talking about the cell phone, the ad-libs, and all that kind of stuff. No, I don't think those moves are carefully planned.
James, I don't know if you saw, but Jonathan Groff was there, and he just was loving it.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah, he just
see Jonathan.
He loved.
I was right next to Tom Viola, who I hadn't seen from Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, and I had a little chat with him, and saw a lot of other friendly faces. I was going to say that the audience just ate it up, loved it. I think it's going to be a huge hit. Is it a limited run? But I was really surprised, because are these fans of the show or of Neil Patrick Harris? Or, I mean, not that. Did so many people see it downtown in the John Cameron Mitchell and then the Ally Sheedy version? Do you remember the Ally Sheedy version of Hedwig?
Yeah,
well, that didn't last very long, but Michael Cerveris did it.
Yeah.
And
Matt
McGrath.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if I think that Adam Pascal actually did it somewhere. I know he wanted to, and he used to sing the songs in concerts.
Uh-huh.
But that brings up an interesting point. I do think that as huge a star as Neil Patrick Harris is, if they wanted to extend this show, they could get someone or even a series.
My wife said Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, I mean, because it's the kind of thing that you want to see different people in somehow. I think that if they got the right people, that it really would continue to draw.
Michael, your German accent's so good. I'm recommending you for the role. I mean, you did that very, very well.
I don't have the high notes.
And all these hit musicals east of Broadway. What's happening there?
I know. That's something. You know, I thought of that too when I thought about Rocky Horror being east of Broadway as well. And as you say, you know, Janis Joplin was east of Broadway as well. You know, so it's
Peter. I sense a column coming on. So we had a wonderful time, Hedwig, and nothing, keeping with our theme, Lena Hall, who I adore, just came out of Kinky Boots. So keeping with our Harvey Firestein theme today. So
I think somebody should really get on Hurt Locker, the musical. I think we need a revival.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. not so much for the Hurt Locker, but as much as all the script updates between the off-Broadway production back in the late 90s to today. If you had seen it at Jane Street, don't hesitate to see it again, because it's got a lot of new material in it, and it's wonderful. It's 90 minutes, no intermission, and the audience just had like an unbelievable time.
They really did.
It's a really, really wonderful thing. Another set of audience that I recognize had a really good time was the Of Mice and Men, but in a very different way. The three of us saw this production of Mice and Men at the Long Acre. And Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I thought it was a very beautiful production directed by Anna Di Shapiro. As I believe I mentioned, I had the luck over the past 15 years or so to see two separate off Broadway productions of this play that both were stellar. And I wish it were easier to look up off Broadway plays. I wasn't able to find information on them that quickly to praise them in retrospect. But the point is, I think it's a really incredibly well written piece. That it's an interesting genesis, because if I believe this story is that Steinbeck wrote it as a novel that contains an extraordinary large amount of dialogue, and then very shortly thereafter it was adapted to the stage. I'm not sure I don't think he himself rewrote it as a play script, but someone else did, but because it required so little actual rewriting, or actually no rewriting, I suppose writing the script really consisted mostly of putting in the stage directions and the blocking, and then the play came to Broadway directed by George S. Kaufman. How's that for history, especially since he's in the news again with Act One at Lincoln Center Theater. And it's just one of the saddest, I think the two saddest things ever written in American history. That's quite a statement, but certainly two of the saddest are Of Mice and Men and The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. But sad in a really, profoundly moving way, not in a melodramatic tear-jerky way. And this is the story of these migrant workers in the 30s just going around trying to get work in California, specifically here, the Salinas Valley. And they are George, who's played by James Franco, who's a very kind of a somewhat taciturn, very close to the vest kind of guy, and Lenny, who obviously has some sort of developmental disability. He would have been called mentally retarded back in the day. I guess that's still what you'd call him. And they have this very unlikely but very close friendship, and it's sort of explained a little bit that later in the play that George knew Lenny's aunt and feels responsible for him for looking after him as they go around, because it becomes clear that Lenny on his own would just not be able to fend for himself. He's very, very sweet and very childlike, but he has this unfortunate habit of, he likes to touch soft things, and this has gotten him into some very big trouble and will in fact tragically get him into even more trouble in this ranch where the two of them end up now. And then Lenny can also become, when provoked, he can become very, very strong and very, very violent. So that's the imminent tragedy of Mice and Men. And the other characters are the other men, workers at the ranch, played by Jim Norton, the wonderful Jim Norton as Candy, and an old man who's lost his hand in a threshing machine, I believe, or something like that, and so they've kept him on for that reason, and he has nowhere else to go because he can't really work, and he's kind of stuck there. Ron Cephas Jones plays Crooks, who's African American, and so there's some really interesting scenes about how the others deal with him and the prejudice against him. Alex Morph plays Curly, the boss's son, who's really just spoiling for a fight, and boy does he get one. Jim Ortlieb is the boss. James McMenamin is Wit. Joel Marsh Garland is Carlson. And I have to single out Jim Parrick, someone of whom I was not previously aware. Apparently he's been on True Blood. People may know him from that. Just excellent as Slim, who's really the guy on the ranch that everyone looks up to, and is really obviously a very solid human being and very wise and understands completely what's, you know, the relationship between Lenny and George and does what he can to defend Lenny. And it's a beautiful, beautiful performance. And then, Leighton Meester, or Leighton, I do not how to pronounce it, don't know how to pronounce it, plays Curly's wife, who is the catalyst for the tragedy. I have a friend in town who happened to be here just during the week when everything was opening. So we saw together, we saw The Cripple of Inishman, Of Mice and Men, and Hedwig, and then he has separately seen about literally four other shows. But he said that Of Mice and Men was his favorite of all that he had seen up to that point. And I certainly understand it. It's another situation, like as Peter mentioned, where I always say you can hear a pin drop. It's that same feeling of the audience being completely, totally involved and engaged. And especially towards the end, I mean, I had tears in my eyes several times. It was, and I had to sit there for a minute before I got up and exited, because it was really a beautiful, devastating production.
All right, Peter, what did you think about it?
Yeah, it certainly was terrific. For all the talk about James Franco, how nice of him in a strange sort of way to take the role of George, which is far less the showy role. Chris O'Dowd gets Lenny, which is the part that we always seem to gravitate to, where our eyes go at any time. I agree that Leighton Meester, with a strange name, but boy, what a performance. Is Curly's wife. Notice she doesn't even have a name. Curly's wife is what it says in the playbill. Yep. Nobody ever refers to her as Susan or whatever.
Right.
So because she really has no real identity out there. And one of the things is she's terribly lonely. She got married on a whim, and now she's paying the price, and she doesn't even like her husband anymore, and he knows it. That's one of the best things about Alec Morph's performance, that he knows it.
Yeah.
This marriage is over. And he has no idea how he's going to contend with the fact that she's the only woman around, and you have all these randy men around, and obviously it's only a matter of time before she cheats on him. That's what drives him crazy. And Alex Morph certainly expresses that very, very well. Very impressive, too, that a play from the 30s should deal with prejudice, because, yes, there is that second act scene where Ron Cephas Jones plays Crooks, a man who stays in his own cabin because he knows he's not welcome elsewhere. He's put up a wall by himself anyway, because if you don't want me, well, then I don't want you, even though he does want them. Who doesn't want to be included in everything? But nevertheless, that's the way he's going to be, because that's the best defense he can have. Tremendously written play. The characters are so interesting, captivating, enthralling. I mean, they're just so well done. Everything, almost every line seems to build on the character and make you understand where the character's coming from more and more and more. However, it is a case where whoever plays Lenny is always going to get the real response at the curtain call. George really is the strange way, even though he has just as much stage time, a supporting role. Hmm. In the sense that he really is supporting what's going on with Lenny. I mean, he's the boss of them. And it's also so sad, too, to hear the pipe dream that always goes on, that that George is always talking about someday we're going to be living off the fat of the land. And Lenny can't get enough of that. And Lenny never asked the question that the rest of us would ask. When? You keep on talking about this. When is this going to happen? You know, he's content to know that it's in the future, that wonderful times are going to be coming for them. And that isn't what happens at all. I find it very, very relevant that my girlfriend said, you know, this play is just too depressing. I've seen it before. I do not want to go. My friend Karen Plesher, who loves movie stars, I thought, okay, I'm going to invite her because here's James Franco. She says it's too depressing. I don't want to go. So I found that really, really of intense interest that that here was this high profile show, and both of them knew this was a great play and certainly one of the hot tickets of the season. But both of them felt life is hard enough, and I just kind of put myself through that. Karen said that the first time she saw it, she cried for part of the next 3 days. So do keep that in mind. You know, it you're not going to come out singing "That's Entertainment," but you are going to sit in your seat for a minute, the way Michael did, because it is that shattering that you want these two guys to succeed. You're on their side. They're such hard workers. They've never really got the break that you want them to have. It also points out about this level of society that these two men are certainly prototypes from millions of others who had to do this, who had this hard scrabble life going from one place to the next, hoping to find work. And the work they find is certainly not the type of work that we're experiencing going to the theater every night of the week during the last week of April. So powerful. Powerful indeed, and thank God the production is up to the play.
And in this case, it's especially heartbreaking because they come so close. It seems like they come really close.
That's right.
And they really might not have, they might have done it. They might have had that farm. They might have pooled their resources and got that farm if it didn't so happen that Curly's wife wound up in the barn alone with Lenny.
That's right.
Yeah, we also had a really amazing experience seeing Of Mice and Men. I felt as though I went into the theater post all the hubbub about James Franco and the New York Times and the review and the that thing on Instagram with James Franco and a young girl. And so I went in and I wasn't sure if that affected my opinion or not, but I didn't really like James Franco in the first bunch of scenes. I felt like he was just shouting and over the top and there wasn't acting going on, but he settled down into a pretty good thing. But Chris O'Dowd just, this whole cast, you know, blew everybody out of the water.
By the way, I was there the night after that scandal broke about the Instagram, and I can't help noticing that when James Franco and Chris O'Dowd, they come on together, they're the first scene, they come on together, there was no entrance applause. And I just had to wonder how much of it had to do with that. Or was it the case that they came on so strangely and quickly that that it sort of short-circuited the applause? I mean, maybe, but I couldn't help wondering if indeed it had something to do with that.
James, since you brought it up, I did want to mention, yes, I felt in the first scene, which is quite long, that that Franco was quite disappointing. It seemed very one note.
Yeah.
He seemed annoyed through the whole scene. And I really was a little worried as to how the rest of the show was going to go. But then, and someone else, at least one other person wrote this in a review, as soon as they got to the ranch, somehow it was completely different, and he was doing emotional transitions and levels and things. But then there was the scene at the end when he first discovers that Lenny has killed Curly's wife. I thought he was lacking in that scene too. It seemed to me like it didn't quite. The stakes weren't quite registering on, you know, and his face and body. And I'm not saying that I expected it to break down and cry, but it just. It didn't seem like he murdered someone. But then in the very final scene, he was just beautiful, just beautifully wonderful, nuanced performance in the way he dealt with Lenny. So it seemed to me like there were moments that maybe he could have worked on more. And I don't know if Anna Shapiro might have helped him in those specific moments. But that was my feeling.
Yeah, I was wondering if it was when he was out there all alone and had to carry the show, if he couldn't really carry it.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, let me just say this, that in terms of when he heard about the murder, I don't know. I had a different reading on that. Okay. It brought to me, to mind, a line from Streetcar Named Desire. We've had the state from the beginning that that he knew that something like this was possible at any given moment, and now it had finally happened. So that was my take on that. Doesn't make me right. I'm just telling you what I thought.
Oh, that's valid.
So... Of Mice and Men runs about 2:30 with an intermission or so. Did you feel that 2:30? I didn't at all. I was like, it flew.
Nope. I agree.
It totally flew for me. So, and again, this is also a limited run. So get there if you can.
Really?
It really is amazing. I was just talking with somebody about this. It feels to me, I'm not sure if you guys have the same experience, but this is an amazing season.
Yeah.
I think that this is like an especially amazing season that we haven't seen the likes of in a number of years.
Well, I think what a lot of people have said, it's an amazing season except for new musicals.
New musicals, right.
I would agree. I would completely agree with that. And then not that there are no good musicals or no aspects of no good musicals.
And we're talking about, you know, how many new musicals this year in comparison. Jennifer Ashley Tepper posted something on Facebook about the numbers, the sheer numbers. We might have had a handful of really bad new musicals, but just overall, we've had more new musicals this season than in many, many seasons past.
If we do look at it as a case of it's a miracle that anything ever gets on, yes, indeed, it was very successful in that regard. No question about that. Well, I'll tell you what occurred to me, though. I mean, on Tuesday we'll have our Tony nominations, and we're going to hear the verbs snubbed and robbed a great deal. And I decided that because I'd been working on this book about the 63-64 season 50 years ago, I decided to put together a list of people who got snubbed during that season. Uh-huh. And I said, let's see if I can find five nominees for each of the categories. And I'm telling you, it's amazing who was snubbed and robbed that season. Snubbed and or robbed, I should say, that season. We'll be prepared for some outrage, and there's been outrage already, you know, with the Outer Critics Circle Award not acknowledging Idina Menzel and the Drama Desk not nominating Cherry Jones. So I mean, those are high profile people. Those are people who a lot of people would have assumed were shoe-ins. So how many shoe-ins are going to be shooed away come Tuesday morning? It's going to be a good question.
Well, did you guys see this? I did not see this personally, but a friend of mine was talking last night, and he swears that among all of the rulings that the Tony Committee has made recently about eligibility, that Cabaret will, in fact, be eligible for Best Revival.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. It will, but Alan Cumming's not going to be eligible for the award. Okay. But I was very surprised about Lady Day.
Me too.
And they, for those who don't know, Lady Day has been considered by the Tony Committee as a play with music, so it's going to be in the play category and not in a musical category, which totally throws a wrench into a lot of different competitions. I mean, Audra would be best
actress in a play,
which was that Masterclass. Did she get that for Masterclass?
But in the supporting category.
Right. In supporting, that's what it was.
Believe me, they ain't putting her in the supporting category this year.
No. So, so Lady Day is, you know, lots of other plays and in fact, you know, lots of other actresses that didn't anticipate going up against Audra in a widely, you know, some were very excited to see her go out of that category, and some were very less than excited to see Audra come into their category.
Absolutely true. I don't know if I mentioned this, I may have, but Bronx Bombers closing when it did.
Yeah.
Director Lonnie Price told me that if indeed Bronx Bombers had run 1 week longer, they wouldn't have been able to do the show there, and the show may not have happened at all. So Bronx Bombers may turn out to be a reason why some woman gets a Tony and some woman doesn't. So, which is pretty odd. Yeah.
All right, let's move forward to our last review of the day that we'll talk about today. And The Cripple of Inishman at the Court Theater, starring, who is that guy, Danny Radcliffe? Is that his name? So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Martin McDonagh's latest?
Of course, you were joking, but one of the reasons you may have actually felt that you couldn't remember his name is because he's not in the play that much, frankly. Here's somebody who I think should be in the featured category, despite the billing over the title, because he disappears for scenes on end. Let me point out my history with this play. I did not see the original production that was off Broadway that is very controversial. A lot of people thought it stunk. I have no idea if it did or didn't, but nevertheless, I missed it. So one day when I was at the Drama Bookshop, because I love Martin McDonagh's work, this was the play I was going to catch up with. So at this point, you know, I'm on the subway and I'm taking the train to New Jersey to the Star Ledger. And I'm telling you, I am laughing so hard while reading this play. The people are looking at me and staring at me and what's going on with you? Okay. Fine. A couple of years later, I decide to read it again while I'm taking the same trip, figuring, well, you know, I mean, I know the jokes now. I mean, I'm not going to, I'm laughing all over again and people are still looking at me. I think it is a hilarious play and I like this production substantially better than the one we had at the Atlantic a couple of years ago. While I'm saying that it's a supporting performance that Daniel Radcliffe has, I mean, in terms of number of lines and stage time, my, what a performance in certainly contorting himself to become the cripple of Inishman, a person who has been certainly ridiculed his whole life. It is taken for granted that it is perfectly all right to say anything to this guy. You don't have to worry about his feelings whatsoever. By the way, if I was somebody Irish, I would really be a little discouraged by this play because it certainly makes the Irish people look stupid and insensitive. And that is certainly, I believe to be Martin McDonagh's intention, that people who live in this part of the world certainly are not the most sophisticated people and certainly aren't sensitive about other people's feelings. And Daniel Radcliffe really establishes the fact that he's seen it all, he's heard it all. While he would like people not to call him Cripple Billy and just Billy, and he does ask for that a few times during the play, The fact remains he doesn't even expect it anymore because he knows that these are the people he's dealing with. And it's very hard to be the smartest person in the room when you are developmentally disabled, and as a result, you know, people just feel that they're superior to you because of that, and it has nothing to do with that. And it really does indicate, you know, that if you live in a small community, really, it's going to hurt you ultimately, because your world becomes a very small world. And that brings us to Pat Short, who's playing Johnny Patine Mike. Well, the names are hilarious in this play. Johnny Patine Mike, who is the person who comes around to your house and tells you what's going on in the neighborhood. He's the town gossip. He refers to it as news, but it's gossip most of the time. And everybody knows what everybody's doing. And he feels he has every right in the world to know everything that's going on in your business. You are not to keep secrets from him. I mean, this is he's the fourth estate there. That's all there is to it. And he just goes through it with such brio. What really makes the play captivating, however, is the fact that towards the end, we find out that some of the people we thought were insensitive had a little more sensitivity than we thought. People come around a bit, you know, and yet, believe me, by the time all is said and done, Martin McDonagh pulls out the rug at the very end, too, for something else that goes on. I'm being purposely evasive because I don't want to give away too much, but nevertheless, I am crazy about this play, and I'm glad that I saw a production that pleases me more than the last one. I was terribly disappointed by the last one, which, by the way, most people adored, but I think this one is far stronger. Sarah Green, wow. Hell on Wheels is Helen. Helen is the first syllable of Helen really tells you who this lady is. She doesn't care about anybody or anything, and she's just built up this real wall that avoids any type of sensitivity. So a true winner, a great great comedy with an underbelly of tragedy. Boy, I could see it over and over again.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I have always liked this play because I think it, one of the reasons is that it does not have, with one exception, it does not have the intense over-the-top violence that and blood that several other Martin McDonagh plays have, and therefore it's easy for you to relax into the comedy. The one moment of violence that it does have, actually, I think... I'm not sure about the motivation for it. I wonder if Peter. Well, I guess it's hard to discuss it because it would be a spoiler. But maybe I'll ask Peter about that outside of the podcast. My experience is actually I preferred the production at the Atlantic, although I think that may have been largely because I went into the play completely cold for that production and was unprepared for just how well written it is, and how that incredible balance of comedy, light comedy and dark comedy, I guess you would say that goes on throughout McDonagh's work. Now that said, this is a very solid production directed by Michael Grandage. I'm not sure. I suppose it's Grandage because he's British. For the Michael Grandage Company that he has brought over from London, and aside from everything else, thank you to him because I think I've said this before. I think that Daniel Radcliffe was extremely poorly served by his directors in his first two Broadway outings, Equus, which was Thea Harricks, and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which was Rob Ashford. Daniel, for what it's worth, was not much of a presence at all, or if at anywhere, in any of the awards for those performances, and I think that that's why it was obvious to me in watching both of those performances that he could have done better, and that they did not help him. I don't know if it was intimidation or partly incompetence, but I really did feel that. And now Michael Grandage has helped him to give a very, very strong performance. The only thing I would say negative is that it seemed to me a couple of times I was sitting very close. And on a couple of occasions when he was not actually speaking, it seemed to me that maybe Daniel's focus flagged just a little bit. But nothing, you know, nothing major, nothing really worth dwelling on. And everyone else was fantastic, as Peter said. The set is quite wonderful. And I'm so glad that the play got a Broadway outing after those two off-Broadway outings. I think it does deserve to be seen by as many people as possible, and I completely share Peter's opinion of Martin McDonagh's work.
But what Martin McDonagh does so well is that he drops something that seems irrelevant in scene two, and in scene five you're laughing because you find out you find out more about that incident that you didn't know about then, but you really have to remember what you saw in scene two, and he keeps you on your toes. And by the way, as a human being, if you talk to Martin McDonagh, you don't see any of this darkness at all. He's a happy-go-lucky, nice guy. I mean, it almost seems incongruous that he could come up with, as Michael says, plays that are often so violent. Lieutenant of Inishmore, which I also think is hilarious, but it's terribly violent because it really points out people fighting and what are they fighting for, and is it worth fighting for? Is it worth losing lives and killing people for what you want? Martin McDonagh doesn't seem like that type of guy at all. I mean, so it makes it even more interesting that he should be this man who doesn't seem to be capable of writing this dark humor.
So, by the way, having read the play several times, maybe you can tell me, there was a quick passing reference early on in this play to a dead cat or a murdered cat somewhere else. Is that the one?
I think there are links in the in these plays that he definitely lets us feel that they're thematically linked here and there. I do believe that because I'm thinking of something else entirely. There's some character who's simply this isn't answering your question, Michael, but nevertheless, there's one character who's called something like, I don't remember the surname, but it's like Jim Callahan's daughter. We never hear her name. Everybody refers to her as Jim. Again, the surname's off. But anyway, Jim Callahan's daughter, blah, blah, blah. Jim Callahan's daughter, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the girl has a name. How come nobody refers to her by name? It's so hilarious. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason for it, yet he gets away with it. He makes us believe that this is what people call people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do think there are thematic links in it. I noticed other things that I can't remember right now that I said, gee, that comes in the other plays. So, yeah, I think there's something to be said for that.
So we've had a season full of I'd hesitate to say non-Broadway types because certainly Daniel has shown up on Broadway previously, but what we would term big Hollywood stars coming in.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be quite the Tony Awards because I think that the Tony Awards, we don't have any big, we have actually horse races here. We have no big runaway hits that I can think of.
Anything can really happen. But, you know, I've often wondered if that four-letter acronym is responsible for some of this, because in recent years we have come across the word EGOT, meaning Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Though I wish it were called TOGE because the Tony would be first, T-O-G-E. That's the way I'd like it to go instead of having Tony last in that acronym. But the fact that this has really become a term, the idea of winning all four awards has become something that is a badge of honor in the entertainment industry. I think it's one of the reasons why people are coming to Broadway. They want that Tony. And I also suspect the people who come to this town and don't get it on their first try decide, that's it. Well, I gave it my shot. I'm not going to bother with Broadway anymore. And again, none of this would hold up in court. I'm not even saying I'm necessarily right, but I'm saying this is occurred to me. We haven't seen Julia Roberts in a while, have we? Yeah, so
yes.
We'll have to wait and see if we see Tom Hanks again, you know. But nevertheless, I think there's something to be said for the idea that the EGOT is responsible for our seeing a lot of these movie stars.
But also, on a related note, really credit to Daniel Radcliffe for coming back twice. Despite, as I said,
I think
he's been asked about this, despite the, you know, not necessarily being getting any awards recognition to speak of, because I know he seems pretty sincere to me, and
I think
he really wants to, you know, he really wants to do this, and
I agree. This is how he wants to spend his time. You know, he doesn't need the money, and so it's really quite wonderful. We're honored to have somebody of this caliber coming back and back and back. And we have every belief that he certainly will come back again after this one's over.
Well, this time next week, we will have to discuss, because as we know, Tuesday morning is the nominations. And so we have lots of other shows that we haven't talked about yet. We're going to try to wrap up the season next week, as well as talk about the nominations. But I guess that's about it for this week. You guys have anything else you want to throw in before we go?
Not really. Monday night I'm going to the New York Pops Gala, tributing Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman. So that's
great.
I'm going to the Actors Fund benefit that night, so that'll be nice. I'm looking forward to that. I haven't been to Cabaret yet, and as somebody who literally, I mean this, put money in the original production, I'm very fond of Cabaret. So yes, indeed.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts at the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can listen to us on other ways, like the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get our show streamed directly to you. Broadway World Radio also plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you go to BroadwayRadio.com, there are contact information for Peter, Michael, or me, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about. talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.